Good morning. It's nice to see all of you this morning.
Likewise.
I have the privilege, as you are obviously aware of, filling in for Rabbi Manning both this week and last week, as I had the privilege to do so. We all woke up this morning to the wonderful news, I'm assuming we all saw it, of the not just release of two hostages, but the, it deserves a round of applause, but the rescue of two hostages on the part of the IDF. At the same time, I'm only going to speak for myself. Obviously, it's still a mixed blessing with mixed emotions because of all of those that, A, have not been released, and unfortunately, those hostages that have not survived, and of course, all of our chayalim and others that are literally risking their lives, some of them never living to tell the story of what they experienced. It's too many of them. One is too many. But at the same time, this is an incredible, incredible nace. And I really believe that our shiur this morning will touch upon this very idea that while HaKadosh Baruch Hu, creates, I use that term intentionally, creates new nisim for us, literally, on the ground, provides us with nisim, at the same time, the expectation seems to be that we too, like these individuals did in Gaza, like these chayalim did of the IDF, that we must take our own initiative. Our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a two-way street. And that segues directly into the topic of our shiur this morning, from Geulat Purim to Geulat Pesach, the reciprocal Purim and Pesach relationship. Were it not for the fact that this year had an Adar Sheni, were it not for the fact that this year were a leap year, then Purim would be in 2 weeks. And Pesach, don't want to freak you out, would be in 6 weeks. Don't worry, it's in 10 weeks. So you can start freaking out in a month because then it will only be 6 weeks away. The two are intrinsically tied because both of them, of course, Pesach and Purim, center around the theme of Geula, the theme of redemption. They are so intrinsically tied that Chazal tied them together. Beyond that, the question will arise, is the connection even deeper? And if so, how? We will begin this morning with a statement in the Mishnah. We will then introduce a further discussion of that in the Gemara. We will go through that together to understand that, to pick that apart a little bit. Then, from there, I intend to raise with you four questions, what I call the Manishtana of Purim. A little bit of a disclaimer. 2 years ago, right here, at this very spot, I gave a shiur which I indeed titled the Manishtana of Purim, or the Four Questions of Purim, or something along those lines. This piece of it is an excerpt from that particular shiur. If we have time, we will then see to me what is such a beautiful quote from Rav Eli Scheinfeld, the Rav, it's on your sheet as well, the Rav of Beit Knesset Neve Hagiva, where my wife and I are privileged to be members. I know him intimately. He is one of the most special individuals I have ever met, period, and I do not say that lightly. And then if we have even more time, if not, it will simply be on your sheet for you to read if you wish, for your own perusal at your own time. Another beautiful insight that I saw online yesterday by a gentleman named Harav Avraham Melamed, not the more famous Harav Melamed. I do not know, if any of you do, please tell me afterwards or now, who this Harav Avraham Melamed is. I tried to research it. I asked a couple of friends that I thought may be in the know, and they were not. But I found him on a website as I was doing a bit of a search late yesterday evening, and his thought came up as well. I mentioned that both Purim and Pesach are, of course, connected thematically. But let's take a look in the Mishnah as to how they are tied together halachically. We have to keep in mind that once upon a time, once upon a time, before we had a fixed calendar, Adar became a mi'uberet, Adar was doubled at the very last minute possible. Or putting it another way, it is by dint of the fact that it was understood that Pesach would be too early on the calendar, on the solar calendar, that an additional month was needed to be added to the lunar calendar, our calendar, in order that Pesach can be in the spring. Or putting it another way, in Chodesh Ha'aviv. Or putting it another way, the Torah, as was just pointed out by Rabbi Safran, mandates that Pesach must be Bechodesh Ha'aviv because Yitziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, was during Chodesh Ha'aviv, during the spring. The issue is, the seasons, of course, are governed by the sun. Our calendar is not. It's governed solely by the moon, except when we need to bend and to bow to the, not to bow to the sun because that's Avodah Zarah, but you get the expression, yes, to bow to the solar calendar in order that Pesach will be Bechodesh Ha'aviv. That's where an Adar Sheni comes in. Whenever there was an adjustment that was necessary for the for calendarical purposes or necessary for example, Kriyat HaTorah purposes, which also relates to the calendar, and I've discussed this here at the OU Center in detail in the past and other shiurim, it was always done at the last minute possible in order to not create confusion. In other words, there was no printed calendar, there was no printing in general, so people wouldn't know what month it was if we were to go ahead, if Beitin were to go ahead and double up another month. So they waited until the month immediately prior to Chag HaPesach, immediately preceding it, and they doubled up the month of Adar. Now keep in mind something. It is now, a few thousand years ago, it is, let's say 2,000 years ago, it is Adar Rishon, the month that we just introduced and we just announced this past Shabbat. Excuse me, I suppose two Shabbatot ago. We celebrated Rosh Chodesh this past Friday and Shabbat. And we're all assuming that Purim is going to be in about a week and a half from now. And then it turns out, oh, wait a moment. Beit Din actually announced that there is going to be an Adar Sheni, a second Adar this year. That's when it transpired. So Purim was already celebrated, and suddenly we heard about the fact that, oh, wait a minute. Next month is Adar Sheni. Next month is the Adar before Pesach. So what do? Do we re-celebrate Purim? Especially when it comes to the reading of the Megillah, which the Mishnah deals with? Let's take a look. And so the Mishnah tells us as follows. Let's say that the Megillah was read, people read the Megillah in the first month of Adar. That's this month. But again, we're living now 2,000 years ago, and there was no fixed calendar. And then, after the fact, V'nit Abarah Hashana, literally, Nit Abraha Shana means the year became impregnated. A Shanat HaIbur, or a leap year, really means a pregnant year, because there's an extra 13th month added on. No, that doesn't mean in any way, shape, or form that those of you in this room, women that have given birth in the past, have to worry that in some future generation, a pregnancy will be 10 months and not 9, but we get the general idea. That was a joke that fell completely flat, but we get the general idea. And that is that the year is pregnant because there is an additional month. That happened after Purim. What do we do? What's the halakha? And the answer is, Korin Ota Ba'adar Sheni. We read the Megillah again the following month. The question does arise, what about the other mitzvot of Purim? Matanot le'evyonim, mishloach manot, the mishtes, su'udat Purim. Are all of those also a requirement and to be doubled up the second month? Or not? May one do so? Matanot levyonim, obviously. Mishloach manot, you can give presents anytime. But the question becomes, from a halachic perspective, is it even a, we'll call it a reshut, is it okay to make an additional su'udah? The answer is to all three of those, it is. But from a halachic perspective, is it required in the second month? That's debated. But one thing is for sure, and that is that Megillat Esther must be read again in the second Adar. Now the question becomes, why? What is the reasoning behind it? And so the Gemara goes on to tell us that, first of all, our Mishnah, while it's recorded as a flat halakha, as a statement, an halachic statement or a mandate, it didn't begin as such. It began, because we're Jews, it began as a machloket, it began with a disagreement. We wake up in the morning, and the first thing we do the first item that we see on our list after, of course, we wash up and get dressed and daven is, what argument do I start today and whom do I start it with? So I actually had one, it wasn't an argument, but on my way here, I take two buses from Givat Zev. I'm waiting for the second bus The bus, the 71, is pulling up at Tzomet Ramot, if you're familiar with the stop. And I'm waiting for the bus. The bus comes to a stop. The door's in front of me. I don't care if I'm on first or on last. What do I care? The door's right in front of me. I'm approaching the store. A gentleman comes this way, and he pushes me very hard out of the way. And I said, Slicha, Anashim lo dochafim Anashim. That's rule number one. People don't push people. I don't care if you're Israeli. If you're a gentleman or a gentlewoman or you're a human being, you don't push other people. Especially when he entered the same bus as I did, just one door in front of me. So there was no reason why he had to push me. So no real argument ensued. It could have become one that I would have stayed out of. But in any event, we're Jews, we disagree. Some people feel it's okay to push. Some people feel, no, you don't push people. I like to, I'm proud of the fact that I am a member of the second view. But this began as a machloket. And the Gemara tells us as follows. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Avin, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Hilchita, the halacha is like Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who happened to have said it in the name of Rabbi Yossi. There are a lot of names there. And the halacha, according to Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, is as follows. Excuse me, is as is recorded in the Mishnah. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan goes on to say, Ushnehem mikra echad darashu. Both opinions, meaning the opinion that we do not re-celebrate Purim in the second Adar because it was celebrated properly in the first Adar, and that is its place, that it should be in Adar Rishon, not in Adar Sheni. And the other view, the prevalent view, the one that is recorded in the Mishnah as the Halakha, both are derived from the same Pasuk, and that is that in Megillat Esther, we are told that Purim must be celebrated every year, Bechol Shana Vishana. I have that excerpted for you towards the bottom of the first page, if you care to take a look at it. The very last words from Megillat Esther, just, I believe, two sources down. Bechol Shana, every year. Understood by Chazal to have several different manifestations of every single year, it must be celebrated the same way. So, how does that connect to this debate? Very simple. Rabbi Eliezer b'Rabbi Yossi Savar, that opinion, Bechol Shana v'Shana, in every year, that in every year Purim must be celebrated at the same time or in the same month. It can't be in the same month if there are two Adars. Ma Kol Shana v'Shana Adar HaSamuch Lishvat. Since every year, meaning an enormative year, when it is not doubled up, when it is not a Shana Me'uberet, Purim is always celebrated, or Megillah is always read in the month of Adar, which follows the month of Shivat, right? Kislev Tevet Shivat Adar. Afkan, here too, in a Shana Me'uberet, in a leap year, Adar HaSamuch LiShvat. Purim is to be celebrated, or the Megillah is to be read in the Adar that it follows on the heels of the month of Shvat. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Savar, he simply holds or is of the opinion that it's the other way around. Just like, I'm just paraphrasing here, just like every other year, we celebrate Purim, we read the Megillah in the Adar HaSamuch LeNisan that is juxtaposed or is placed next to Nisan, in this case, immediately preceding the month of Nisan. He's looking forward. That's a whole beautiful thought on its own, looking forward as opposed to looking backward. That's not where we're going this morning, but one could take it in that direction if they wish to. Afkan, here too, in a leap year, Adar HaSamuch LeNisan. The Megillah must be read in the Adar immediately preceding Nisan. If it turns out that the Megillah was already read in Adar Rishon, and then it was announced by the Beit Din, by the court, that Purim will indeed take place in, or excuse me, that there will indeed be a second Adar, the Megillah must be read again in the second Adar, so that it is read in the month immediately preceding the month of Nisan. Okay. Then the Gemara goes on to explain one explanation that is offered of Rabbi Eliezer by Rabbi Yossi, explains that the reason why the first opinion, the reason for the first opinion that the Megillah is read in the first Adar, as opposed to the second, is because of a general rule, an umbrella rule, an important rule. Ein ma'avirin al ha-mitzvot. We do not pass over mitzvot. If we have the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, mitzvah haba'al yadcha, al tachmitzena, literally a play on the word chametz, don't let it become chametz. Now that's interesting for our purposes, because the source of ein ma'avirin al ha-mitzvot is the pasuk, ushimartem et ha-matzot, that you are to guard the matzot to make sure they don't become chametz, And the wording, therefore, of the dictum is, as I mentioned, mitzvah haba'aliyadcha al tach mitzena, from the word chametz. I'm sorry? Do not allow it to become chametz. Do not allow it to leaven. Meaning, if you have the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, don't delay, do it right away. So that's the general rule. That is why a brit milah, when possible, should be done earlier in the morning as opposed to later in the day, so that the new baby begins his life with this idea instilled in him, whatever that may or may not mean, that we don't delay when we have the opportunity to perform mitzvot, or in general, that procrastination is usually not the best approach to take, even though I happen to be the master of procrastination. In any event, what about the other reasoning, the logic that is followed in the Mishnah? The answer is, and I highlighted this for you, mismach geula li geula adif. Yes, we have this general principle, but sometimes we will override a general principle, even when it comes to halakha from an halachic perspective, because of a specific reasoning that applies in a specific case. Here, in this particular case, mismach, meaning the juxtaposition, the placing together of the Chag of Purim, which celebrates Geula, which celebrates our redemption, next to, in the month immediately preceding, Pesach, which also, of course, is a celebration, not also, but is the ultimate celebration of the ultimate Geula, at least in biblical times, in the time of the Torah, mismach Geula li Geula, that supersedes the general rule of Ein Ma'avirin HaMitzvot. And therefore, Purim must be celebrated, or the Megillah must be read in the month immediately preceding the month of Nisan. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
It seems to me that the Mitzvah when is the Mitzvah?
Okay.
When the Mitzvah is.
Right. You're saying the case presented is retroactive, yes, and you can't apply it going backward, retroactively. That's a very good point, except this particular opinion is that this is the way that it should be lichatchila. In other words, let's say we were to know in advance that there's going to be a second Adar. Let's say today with the fixed calendar, okay? While we celebrate Adar Purim in Adar Sheni, this approach is no. Purim should be celebrated in Adar Rishon, lichatchila, even in advance. That is a halakha at the outset. And that is why, if it so happens that after Purim it was announced, we follow that approach, because that is the proper approach in any event. Okay? Okay. Very good.
So why don't we do it today?
The halakha is that the rule of mismach geula li geula takes precedence over, supersedes the general umbrella, the general idea of Ein Ma'avirin HaMitzvot. Okay? All right. Very good. What I would like to do now is to, as I mentioned before, raise four questions relating to Megillat Esther. And I believe that these questions, I call it the Manishtana just to be cute, of course, and to tie them together in my own, I don't know, weird brain way, but in any event, I believe this will help us develop further or share an even further insight into this idea of being mismach geula li geula. So let's take a look. There are two stories that are told in the Gemara. Esther was a very, very powerful woman. The chachamim that she went to learned their lesson, and that is that you listen to Esther. Because if you don't listen to Esther, you're going to end up listening to her anyway. You might as well listen at the outset so you have time to binge on Netflix later on in the evening, because she ain't budging until she gets her way. Let's take a look. Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Shalcha lehem Esther lechachamim. The story happened already. And Esther wants this to be established as a chag for all future generations. So she sent them the following message. Kivuni lidorot. Establish me for future generations. Make me a chag, like the other chagim. But of course, it's not going to be a chag de oraita, it's going to be a chag de rabbanan, a rabbinic level chag, as opposed to a Torah or God-mandated chag. By definition, this is a chag that would be instituted if Esther were to have her way, and she will, of course, by the chachamim. They answered back to her, you know what? Maybe perhaps they're thinking, or even said to her, we like the idea, but strategically, it's not a good one. Why? Doing so will arouse jealousy between us and the other peoples, the other nations. In other words, while we are celebrating our victory, by definition, the opposition will see it as celebrating their downfall. Now remember, we go out of our way on Chag HaPesach, which is directly, intrinsically related to Chag Purim, as we already saw, by spilling some blood when we recite the Eser Makot. Why? Because of the Pasuk, if not coined by David HaMelech, then certainly incorporated into Tehillim by David HaMelech, Binfol Oyivcha Al Tismach. When your Oyev, when your enemy falls, literally, do not rejoice. We can rejoice in our salvation. We always have to be mindful of the fact that people died. It's also one of the reasons given, one of two reasons given, for the fact that on Chol HaMoed Pesach, through the end of Pesach, even in Yom Tov, we only recite Chatzi Hallel, only recite what we'll call the half Hallel. It's really the full Hallel minus two paragraphs. So we recite the much larger half, if there is such a thing. We only recite Chatzi Hallel. Why? So the reason given in the Talmud Bavli, in the standard Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi is a different reason recorded, is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Ma'asei Adai Tovim Bayam, V'atem Olmim Shira, my creations, yeah, they're the Egyptians, yeah, they pursued you. Sure, yeah, they enslaved you, but they're my creatures. I created them, they're human beings too. They're drowning in the sea, and you, the Malachim, want to sing? What's the matter with you? How can you be so insensitive? On the other hand, how can God be so insensitive to the need, God forbid, to the need to sing and to thank him? And so a compromise was put in place. Of course we thank God, but we kind of mitigate it. We just push it back. We take it a step back just a little bit because we have to always be mindful that people died. In any event, they then said to her, this is not a good idea. It's not going to go down well if we were to institute this. Shalchalahem, she sent back to them, yeah, you would be right, except for one thing. They have it in their own recordings. Kvar kituva ani al divrei hayamim malchei madai ufaras. In their own recordings, in their own journals. My story, our story, is already recorded. They know the story. Now, this is the end of the story, the way that the Gemara presents it. My guess is that they went back and forth more, because they probably, or could have easily said to her, I'm assuming they did, yeah, it's one thing for something to be written and stored away, on their bookshelves. It's another thing for it to be literally in your face by celebrating in the streets. But in any event, she gets her way. There's another story. And in this story, it's not Kivuni establish me, it's Kitvuni. It's record me for all future generations. In other words, canonize me. Make my story a part of Tanakh. What we will call today the book of Esther. Sefer Esther or Megillat Esther. And they answered back to her, instead of going through this inside, I'm just going to paraphrase, is there is a pasuk in a completely different context, which on a pshat level is not referring to this idea at all, but it can be understood to mean that when it comes to a recording of any war we had with Amalek or his descendants, there can only be three recordings. So let's take a look. The first recording we have, do not worry about the source for now because of a lack of time. The first recording we have is what we read on Purim morning that we read just a few weeks ago in Parashat Bo, Parashat Bishalach, and Parashat Bishalach, in the aftermath of the Kriyat Yamsuf, of Az Yashir, the splitting of the sea. When Amalek came in, they attacked us. The second recording, by the first reasoning of the Chachamim, is when that same war is re-recorded at the end of the Torah in Parashat Ki Tetzeh, what we will call Zachor, what we read on Parashat Zachor, the mitzvah to remember what Amalek did to us when they attacked us 39 years prior. That's two recordings. The third recording is a story with Amalek in the time of Shaul HaNavi, and that entire played out story there, that is discussed in detail. That's already three recordings. One moment, please. That's already three recordings. There is no room for a fourth. So sorry, Esther. Well, maybe we would like to. Our hands are tied. We cannot canonize you. I'm sorry. I apologize. King Saul. I'm sorry, Shaul HaMelech. If I said Shaul HaNavi, I misspoke. And I was... Yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you. I had a chance to correct myself because I'm being recorded. So, yes, Shaul HaMelech, thank you. Okay, very good. So we can't. And then the source goes on to say, the Gemara goes on to say, Ad shematz ulo, until they found, which means they're clearly going out of their way to try to accommodate her, either because Esther was pushing back or they realized she's correct. We want to accommodate her without her pushing back. And then they realize, wait a second, the first two sources, they're one and the same story. Zachor is about the same war that happened 39 years earlier. That can count as one. So the story of Shaul HaMelech, thank you, is two. And then there's room for yours. And so she gets canonized, and we read Megillat Esther every year. The question becomes, why was Esther so adamant? Why, it's my question, why was she so insistent? There have been other salvations of Am Yisrael. Esther stepped up to the plate and said, we need to make a big deal out of this. Why? Why such a big deal? I'm going to skip question number two for now. Let's take a look at what I labeled as question number three. If your format is the same as mine, then on the bottom of the page, it will say question three in the heading of the excerpt, and then the quote will be on page two. I'm not sure if yours is the same as mine. But it's Pasuk Chaf Aleph in Megillat Esther Perek Tet. And there we are told, L'kayem Aleihem, we are to establish these days of Purim in future generations. What we just discussed was some of the backstory as to how that actually came about, the details that are not included in the Megillat Esther. L'hiyot osim et yom arba'a asar l'chodesh Adar, ve'et yom chamisha asar bo b'chol shana v'shana, on the 14th and on the 15th. Meaning, cities that are unwalled cities celebrate Purim on the 14th, since on the 15th, we know the history, they fought an additional day in Shushan, just like Shushan was a fortified or a walled city, therefore all cities that are fortified also celebrate on the 15th, on the 15th because they fought another day. I think I may have spoken a moment ago, the initial war was on the 13th, and then the war was over virtually everywhere, and so the following day, they celebrated, except for in Shushan, Ahasuerus gave Esther permission to continue fighting for another day on the 14th, and therefore they only celebrated on the 15th, and that is what is done every single year in walled cities. Pasuk Kafbet goes on to say, to replicate what was done that particular year, as Avi Herzog just pointed out, and then in the middle of line two, V'hachodesh asher nepach lahem miagon l'simcha, nepach has the same shoresh, same root word as the word v'nahafoch, the song we sing, v'nahafochu, that's also a quote from Megillat Esther, just a few psukim away, the month that was switched or changed from yagon, from sadness to simcha, to rejoicing, u'me'evel yom tov, from mourning, literally mourning, to yom tov, la'asot otam, to make them, it is a mandate to make these days, yimei mishteh v'simcha, and mishloach manot ish l're'ehu, and u'matanot le'avyonim. I challenge you to find another chag, and we all know you're not going to find one, so don't even bother looking, where we have this mitzvah of mishloach manot, where we have this thought of sharing gifts with one another. And because we're Jews, we share food as opposed to other gifts. Matanot le'avyonim. I challenge you to find another chag in which we have this institution of something along the lines of matanot le'avyonim. Yes, there's a mitzvah to give tzedakah every day. The closest we can come to is the other chag ha'geula that we're discussing this morning, is exactly right, is ma'ot chitim, also referred to in Aramaic as kimcha de pischa, literally meaning flour for Pesach, or providing for matzot, and of course, the arba kosot yayin, and the other needs for the meal to be able to have this what we'll call the seder of Pesach. That's in advance in order to be able to celebrate then. But the idea of giving out matanot le'adyonim on the day itself that aniyim are looking forward to, we only find it by Purim. When it comes to chagim de rabbanan, there are, or were, only two. Now, Baruch Hashem, one could argue that we have more. Yom Ha'atzma'ut, Yom Yerushalayim, but Chanukah and Purim. In a way, they're parallel chagim. There's no halakha that one must have a mishteh, that one must have a su'udah, a festive meal on Chanukah. And yet Esther and Mordechai put their heads together and they said, okay, but on Purim, we are going to. It's really quite fascinating. And the question, of course, becomes why? What were they getting at? And again, why were they so adamant? And the fourth question derives from the very last pasuk of Megillat Esther, or the last perek. Now, to be sure, the chapter and verse that we have are not our own. Just to make sure that we're aware of this historically, I believe we all may be. That came later. It is Christian in origin, or at least printing presses in origin, the chapters and verses that we have today. So this idea of there being a Perek Yud of chapter 10, as opposed to simply being a postscript to chapter 9 or being a part of chapter 9, that is not Jewish in its origin. But either way, of course, we refer to Perek and Pasuk because there never was and is no better system in place. And that's why Perek and Pasuk are always what I refer to, literally chapter and verse, even though they're not Jewish in origin. Perek Yud, the way that we have it, is simply a few psukim, and tells us as follows. Achashverosh placed a mas, placed a tax. In other words, now that the war was over, now that the Jews were saved, now that this episode is over, life resumed. Life went back to what here in Eretz Yisrael we call the Shigra. Life went back to normal, everyday living. Pasperek Yud, Pasuk Bet, the greatness of Mordechai, all of that is recorded in Divrei Hayamim, in the chronicles of the kings of Madai Umparas, which we know that Esther used this factoid, Esther used in her argument with the Chachamim, based on the explanation that we saw in the Gemara. And then we find a fascinating pasuk. And to me, and I'm not the only one that raised this issue, this question, is this pasuk, number one, seems out of place. Number two, it's completely unnecessary. It's completely superfluous. The Gemilah could have ended there. And these two psukim that we just read could have been the conclusion of Perek Tet, the conclusion of the entirety of the Megillah, of Megillat Esther. And yet we find the following pasuk. This is the culmination. Ki, after all, Mordechai HaYehudi, or maybe because, however you want to translate that word, Mishne Lamelech Achashverosh, he was second in command to King Achashverosh, yes, V'gadol HaYehudim, which can be translated as he was a great Jew, or great for the Jews, I bolded these words for you. V'ratzui l'rovechav. These words are explained in further detail and picked apart in detail in the Gemara. V'ratzui l'rovechav. He was accepted by and wanted, desired by, literally rov, a majority of his brethren. So the Gemara says a majority as opposed to all of them, because some people were opposed to Mordechai because he refused to bow down and they blamed him for the whole episode with the war, for the ensuing war that transpired in the first place. Had he bowed down, then none of this would have happened, etc. Doresh tov la'amo, he sought good for his people. V'dover shalom, and he spoke of peace, l'chol zaro, for all of his seed, for all of his future generations. What's that pasuk doing there? What do we need it for? So I would like to suggest that what Esther is presenting here, what Mordechai is presenting here, what Megillat Esther, what all of the various texts that we saw are presenting to us is that there's an underlying theme. And that theme is the key. Maybe we picked up on it already. But that theme is the key to our success. It was the key to our success in the story of Esther. It was the key to our success and our deliverance into freedom, to our geulah, our redemption, going back to the story of Pesach, literally, mismach, the juxtaposition of geulah to geulah. And it is the key to our survival, to our success, whenever we as an Am are in dire straits, namely, that we must be an Am and not split apart and not be splintered. Esther understood that it is not enough for the story to have taken place and for us to have survived. Because what good will that do when that is just shelved? And even if it's recorded and literally shelved, what good will that do if we're not reminded of that every single year, year in and year out? That if there ever comes a situation akin to the situation we, meaning Esther and Mordechai, found ourselves in, if it ever is to arise again, like literally today as we are sitting here, privileged to learn Torah in the OU Center, we must remember that the key is Achdut. The key is unity. B'yachad ninatzeach is an incredible, incredible slogan. And it's really on the mark, and we see it everywhere. Our challenge is to make sure that it remains much more than just a slogan when this war is in Yirtzeh Hashem over soon. To take that B'yachad ninatzeach and to remind ourselves daily that has to be our attitude. In order to have achdut, you forgive me, but people don't push people. They treat each other, and that's why I introduced that little factoid, that little episode with me from this morning. We treat each other with respect, and we can be different.
With kindness.
I'm sorry?
Kindness also.
Basic kindness. Thank you. Basic human kindness. Human decency. We don't have to be on the same page. We don't even have to be in the same location. And we don't even have to be celebrating Purim on the same day in order for us to be instilled and to constantly remind ourselves of this idea that we are in this together. And all of our questions will fall by the wayside if we just think about this for a moment. Working backwards, chiastically. Mordechai, the last pasuk points out, he was Ratzui l'rov echav and not l'chol echav. Not everybody was in favor of him. There were many people that blamed him. What? There weren't other great halachists around that did bow down to Haman? He's the sole individual that didn't bow down? Mordechai, are you crazy? You are endangering our lives? The lives that we are threatening any future of Am Yisrael? Have you lost your mind? There are many that felt that way. Perhaps rightfully so. But the pasuk reminds us of something that may be true. Who knows? Maybe he blew it. Maybe. But just remember the beginning of the pasuk. Mordechai Ayehudi, Gadol LaYehudim. That's number one. His heart was in the right place. We all make mistakes. I'm not saying he did. But even had he made a mistake, a grave error, look where his heart was. Doresh Tov LaAmo, the end of the pasuk. This is how the Megillah ends. He sought after the good of his people. V'dover shalom. And he spoke of peace. The Megillah ends that way, I believe, in order for us to understand that even if Mordechai was only Ratzui l'rov echav, and not l'chol echav, not to all of his brethren, he wasn't loved by everybody for the reasons that we mentioned, which really are pretty obvious. At the same time, keep in mind what he set out to accomplish. Working backwards, Mishloach Manot, Ishler Ehu. As Rabbi Yudin Shlita of Fairlawn, New Jersey, my wife and I lived in Fairlawn for 24 years, would say year in and year out from the pulpit, don't just give Mishloach Manot to your best friends. Do give them too, and give through the Shul project. And he would add that every year too, and he would smile because he was the Rav of the Shul, and of course the Shul made a lot of money off the Mishloach Manot project, and he had to say it, but or maybe he didn't have to, but in any event, he made a point of saying, you know, the person down the block that has a menorah in their window, and therefore you think they might be Jewish, because who knows these days, especially in America, give them Mishloach Manot. The person you're no longer on speaking terms with, it happened so long ago, you don't even recall why you're not speaking to each other, go out of your way to give them Mishloach Manot. Is it uncomfortable? You bet it's uncomfortable. But if we don't do that, we're missing the idea behind giving Mishloach Manot in the first place. Matanot Le'Avyonim then, of course, speaks for itself. And so does this idea of Mishteh, this idea of sitting down together for a meal, of joining together as much as we possibly can. Even if you're at work and you're sitting in your little cubicle, do something to remind yourself of the fact that this might literally be my meal that I'm eating by myself and taking a quick 10-minute break from work. But keep in mind that we are all in this together. There's something special about that su'udah, about that mishteh on Chag Purim. All of the mitzvot Purim are centered around this theme of achdut, this theme of unity, the key to our survival. I'm sorry? Yes. Y-U-D-I-N. Yes. Rabbi Benjamin Yudin. Yes. Yes. Okay? Of Congregation Shomrei Torah. Okay. I mentioned to you before, even if we celebrate Purim on two separate days, Because remember, we began with a halacha this morning, or towards the beginning, that Purim is celebrated on two separate days, because originally, by dint of the fact that in Shushan they fought for an additional day and they couldn't celebrate that day, they that year celebrated on two separate days, and therefore in every ensuing year we celebrate on two separate days. Think about that for a moment. Yeah, it's important to recall the history, okay. Is it important enough that we actually celebrate Purim on two separate days? We don't do that for any other Chag. Now, yes, for any other Chag, there was no fighting an additional day in Shushan. Okay, fine. We read that. We know the history. We're sitting here 6 weeks in advance, right? Not two because of Shana Me'uberet, rereading or pre-reading, I suppose, the story. We all know the halacha. Little kids in day school today, Baruch Hashem, learn that in walled cities, for example, Yerushalayim, they celebrate Purim the following day, even known as Shushan Purim. But to the extent that we actually celebrate on two separate days, if the theme is Achdut, if the theme is unity, isn't that Pumfakert? Isn't that reverse logic? Shouldn't we, by definition, be celebrating together? So let's take a look at a beautiful insight from Harav Eli Sheinfeld of Neve Haviva. And rather than going through the Ivrit, simply because of the time on the clock, which I would love to, because his prose is, to me, just so beautiful. Let's take a look at the translation. The translation is my own. Why do we all rejoice together, and why do we not all rejoice together in the celebration of Purim? This question takes on even greater strength in light of Esther's decree, Lech kenos et kol ha'yudim ha'nimtzi'im b'shushan. Go and gather all the Jews. Let's take a break from this quote, from this excerpt from Rav Eli Sheinfeld for just a moment, and just refresh our memories here. Mordechai told Esther, right, at a certain point, you need to go, you're the only one that is literally in among us. You're the only one that can approach the Melech. You need to go to your husband and say, dear hubby, you need to know what's actually going on here and who this Haman dude is, what this Haman dude is really all about. And her response is, yeah, but it doesn't work that way, Mordechai. And you, I think she probably assumed that he knew that. And you know that. I can't just go to him. Because if I'm not summoned, and if he doesn't literally reach out his sharvit, his staff, to me, I can be killed. And his response is, that's right. It's true. The chatufim would still be in Gaza today, the two that were released, if the attitude of these IDF soldiers is, we can't go in. It's too dangerous. Our lives are at risk. Esther, you're right. It doesn't matter. Who knows? That's Umi Odea. Maybe this is why you have achieved this particular position. Maybe this is why you became queen. Maybe this is why behind the scenes HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw to it that you would be here now so that you can go to him. I can't. You can go. You might not make it. Go. And she does. And then we're mefatzel, we split the days, and we celebrate Purim on two separate days. Not only does she risk her life, how does she respond? Think about it. I'll go on one condition. If everybody else, those who are physically able, vitzumu alai, fast for me for 3 days. That year, we're told, it was Chag HaPesach, 11 months before Adar. Here's another connection between the two geulot. It's built into the story of Purim itself. They did not celebrate Pesach this year. They did not have the Arba Kosel Tzayin. They did not eat the Matzot. Those that could fasted. Why? Because Esther understood. The only way that A, my request can be granted for a reversal, and the only way for me to be able to make it out alive, literally, is if we're in this together. Everybody else has to do their part. If I do my part and everybody else is sitting back wondering and worrying, and they should be worried about me no matter what, of course, and davening is important, and reciting Tehillim everywhere you go to make sure that I survive and that Haman and his decree are reversed, that's all fine and good. What about proactively being involved? Not only is that better, that is crucial. And it must be done. And on that condition, I will go. So now when it comes to the institution of Purim, We celebrate on two separate days? Are we crazy? And so Rav Eli, with my translation, goes on to explain. Why is a holiday which symbolizes unity more than all of the others celebrated in a split manner, meaning on separate dates? It would appear that this is precisely the message of the Chag. Achdut, unity, is a spiritual movement, an inner feeling that is not dependent upon a place and time. We can and we must be united even when we celebrate at different times and at different places. Achdut is an inner strength that is not dependent on place and time. And I heard Rav Eli explain and explicate upon this idea even further orally in the Beit Knesset itself, in our shul. And he explained that perhaps this is exactly the point. Of course, it could have been mandated. The halakha could have simply been that everybody celebrates Purim on the 14th, and keeping in mind that in Shushan, that one year, the origin of Purim, they did not yet celebrate till the following day. Everybody knows that. But perhaps Rav Eli suggests that it was bidavka, intentionally, that Purim was instituted to be celebrated on two separate days, yes, to recall and to incorporate this historical fact, the historical war, in order to imbue in us the depth of this idea of achdut, of unity. And that is that we are united even when we seemingly are not. As I mentioned before, we can achieve achdut even if we are in different places. We can achieve achdut even if we are coming from different angles, even if we approach everything about life, even our observance of halakha, differently. But mindfully, we are Am Echad. We are Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. And we have to make sure to maintain that. And when Purim is celebrated on 2 days instead of just one, perhaps, just perhaps, Rav Eli explained, that is in order to stress the point that we are to be united even when we are celebrating on two separate days. That's the idea of Eli Scheinfeld. Any other questions or comments before we conclude? Okay. Harav Abraham, yes, I'm sorry.
We always learned that the reason for the 2 days was to give Hashiva's parents a start, because loving Jerusalem and...
A few other, it's okay, a few other locations, yeah.
The capital of...
Shushan, okay.
Would be the second day.
I like that idea. There are a lot of reasons that are given. That may be the reason you learned, and that's wonderful. There always have been other reasons in addition, and this to me would be a new, not reason necessarily, but certainly a novel idea behind it of Rav Eli, okay? But thank you. There are different approaches. Rav Avraham Alamed, again, I never heard the name until yesterday. I have not been able to discover who this Rav Avraham Alamed is. He's on a particular website, and I also meant to cite the website for you, and I inadvertently forgot to do so. No, do not worry, we're not going to go through his text inside. What he basically shows is that not only do we have this intrinsic, reciprocal relationship between Purim and Pesach, but it really is reciprocal. I labeled my shiur this morning reciprocal relationship before I saw what he writes. And he basically explains that if you take the Chag of Pesach and the Chag of Purim, yes, of course, they're both centered around the theme of Geula, but coming at it from opposite ends, from a completely different angle, or, if you will, the flip side of a coin. Chag HaPesach could be perceived, of course, as the ultimate, certainly the primary, or the, in the sense of literally the first Geula of Am Yisrael, emanated from God. It was God who interceded and interfered on our behalf, through, of course, the Eser Makot, through the sending of Moshe prior to the Eser Makot, through literally splitting the sea for us, through delivering us. That emanated from God. And it's important, of course, to always have that reminder that Me'et Hashem Hayit Hazot Hini Flat Be'einenu. This is from God, and that is what makes it wondrous in our eyes. The very fact that it emanates from God. Okay. How long does that last? Then what? We tend to forget. And the way Rav Melamed puts it is, B'nai Israel, just a few weeks later, 7 weeks later, they committed at Har Sinai to this idea of, he doesn't mention it, but Vayichan, the unity in their encampment at Har Sinai, he doesn't mention that, but he does mention that they were so moved that they were willing to accept the Torah. And even in Megillat Esther, according to our sages' understanding, there's a reference back to Har Sinai of, you may be familiar with it, Ki Emuv Ki Belu, literally that the Jews re-accepted what they had accepted back at Sinai, at the Sinai revelation. That is true. And then what? Just because this generation is committed, and we all know this, doesn't mean the next generation is committed. Or just because an individual is committed this year, doesn't mean they'll be committed next year. Chag Purim, on the other hand, it began with man's initiative, or woman's. It began with the initiative of Esther and Mordechai. Of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is working behind the scenes. Only behind the scenes, so much so, as our Malame reminds us, that Hashem's name isn't even mentioned in Megillat Esther, not even once. We don't give thanks or credit to where credit is ultimately due to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, herself, itself. We do, but only in the background. As Rav Malame points out, the Geula of Purim is a celebration, or our celebration of Chag Purim is all about a Geula that came about because of the initiative and through the initiative of man. Because it is through the initiative of man that we will constantly recall what happened. Anytime an individual achieves something, it lasts. It lasts for them and has a greater chance of lasting for their offspring, for the future generations as well. The stories we tell of our Bubbies and our Zadies, those are the stories that make an impression to so many people, rightfully or wrongfully, it's human nature, more than the stories of, you know what God did thousands of years ago? And so we need both. And we have this concept of Mismach Geula Ligeula, Rav Malame so eloquently explains. This idea of the juxtaposition of the Geula that emanates from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Geula that emanates from man. Both of these are key ingredients, not only to our survival, but both of these are key ingredients to ensuring that we will be appreciative of the Geula that HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided for us in the first place with Yitziat Mitzrayim in Chag HaPesach, and then later on in the story of Chag Purim. And in this vein, if we keep in mind that the theme of Achdut, that the key to our survival as expressed by Esther and Mordechai incorporated into the halachot of Chag Purim, and in our celebrating of Chag Purim, are the key to our survival. And if we do our utmost to daily remind ourselves of, yes, this wonderful slogan of Biyachad Nenatzeach, together we will be victorious, that we don't dare allow it to remain just a slogan, then in Yirtzeh Hashem, the Geula that we began to experience with Hakamat HaMedina in 1948 will continue. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will see us through not only this Milchama, but any ensuing tsarot, any ensuing troubles that we find ourselves in, and in Yirtzeh Hashem, we will be able to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu just as we thanked him and sang Shira at the splitting of the Yam Suf, and just like we celebrate Purim year in and year out. That is the key to our success. I wish you all a wonderful day and a wonderful week.